Thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure and a privilege to be able to address this group at a time when I believe conservatives or classical liberals, as I guess many of us are preferring to call ourselves, are looking at a world that has changed. Not so much that the great principles, the guiding stars that we follow or that we are pointed by, have changed, but the environment in which we find ourselves has changed, and particularly in one area in which Americans have always had a traditional blind spot, an area in which they have always, almost always, preferred not to deal, which is the area of foreign policy. Since the Founding Fathers and the days of George Washington and isolationism ended, basically with Teddy Roosevelt and the Great White Fleet and the Spanish-American War, we have seen a United States that has vacillated in terms of our obligations and of our commitments and of our interests overseas between an emphasis on morality and a shrewd and very directed interest in our trade and in our economy. This came, of course, to a head with the great wars, World War I and World War II, which we, in effect, expressed to our people, and correctly, as crusades to save democracy. And World War II, at least, certainly was that. However, the world since the Second World War has been a less, for us, clear one. The Second World War eliminated one great evil empire and enhanced another. And Americans, without a sense of philosophy and direction in foreign policy, and particularly we conservatives or classical liberals, found it very easy, in effect, to create for ourselves a policy of opposing what was clearly evil rather than clearly fomenting and supporting that which was, from our point of view, right and consistent. Now, this has taken also and taken root from this dilemma, a propensity of American policy leaders to oppose communism in Korea and then later in Vietnam and in Nicaragua, and evil in other guises, be it in Somalia, Haiti, or Bosnia, for reasons which I believe have been confusing to us, and because they were confusing at the outset, have resulted in confusion of American purpose. And that confusion is very much with us today, and I believe is going to cost us dearly. In Korea, using the United Nations basically as a front, we were able to do what we had to do to block a naked Soviet-backed aggression, which would have undermined the credibility of the Western world and greatly advanced the cause of the communist empire. However, we paid a price for this. Although we did what we had to do in blocking an enemy, we had to also compromise. We had to, in effect, stop short of victory. And in a sense, the dilemma posed by Korea was summed up in the great confrontation between Harry Truman and Douglas MacArthur. One in which Harry Truman was entirely correct by what he did in terms of establishing and reinforcing the ultimate authority of the civilian commander-in-chief of the United States in time of war. But we cannot also ignore that in his error or in his downfall, Douglas MacArthur made a very telling point, and that is that in war for a democracy, there is no substitute for victory when the cause you pursue is correct. And in a sense, these words, although they were uttered on a losing side, haunt us today. Take Vietnam as we move forward from Korea. It was presented to us as a crusade, as preventing communism, and as somehow bolstering a less evil regime in the south of Vietnam in the name of democracy. Using this, the Kennedy administration, and then with a vengeance the Johnson administrations, brought American draftees into a conflict which seemed in effect to be holding the wall against the communists for the American interest and a greater cause. And for that, Americans were ready to give up their lives. And after all, in a democratic society, the base denominator of everything that counts is the individual human life. The government that disregards that, from our point of view, is evil. The government that promotes it, or that most promotes it, is doing the most good. This is possibly a controversial point of view, but one which I think we need to think about, at least. In Vietnam, however, with the end of the Johnson administration, it was clear that we were pursuing a policy that was not winning, that didn't intend to win, but yet that we weren't letting go of. Richard Nixon came to power, promising an end to the war, and he could, I believe, have ended it, both militarily and politically, except that there was a game being played. A game of nations, a game which goes back, of course, in centuries to the beginning of time, in which the United States was playing the great power role between China and Russia, and Vietnam became a convenient pawn in this larger chessboard. And when American, and for that matter, South Vietnamese young people, became victims of a war that ground on, that could have been ended, and which Americans did not intend to end, I believe we departed from the legitimacy of our use of our people in conflict and entered into an immoral war. It ended because we were able to set up a truce which would have held and which might have produced another Korea had not the Nixon administration fallen, and with that, all will to enforce the treaty, and with that, of course, Vietnam fell like a house of cards. In Nicaragua, more to our interest today, we saw basically a clearly communist regime, an evil regime, take power in Nicaragua. When I was ambassador in Costa Rica, I had all too many people who were willing to disbelieve in the war in Nicaragua, saying it was like the end game in Nicaragua and in Vietnam. And to convince them otherwise, I needed only to take them up to the refugee camp in Costa Rica at Tilaran and show them the peasant farmers who had fled from communist oppression in Nicaragua, where their food supplies were taken, their seed grain was taken, and unless they allowed their children to be taken, they would not have been fed. This, to me, is consummate evil was the nature of communism. When we started, basically, to continue to attempt to get the Nicaraguan freedom fighters to help themselves, while on the other track, we attempted to negotiate a peace, a settlement, a covering of the dirt under the rug at negotiations in Mexico, I believe we went the way that we went in Vietnam. The game, in effect, took precedence over the principle. This problem, of course, tragically ended in one sense, but well in another, when the Sandinistas made a mistake and ultimately cost themselves direct power. But in the confusion that followed, in the lack of a victory and a definition by the forces of right, Nicaragua today is still prostrate, because too much power still remains in the hands of the residual former communists, who are now basically thugs. They were communist thugs before, they are thugs now. Nicaragua will have a long road back. I believe it will come back, but no thanks to us. Very few thanks to us, in terms of broad principle. Looking to Somalia, we went in, I think, with the best of intentions, And we did a good thing in the first round of Somalia, where we actually did interpose ourselves between 1 million people and death for lack of food. But with the change of administrations came a craving to engage in social engineering in a part of the world in which there were no good people, very few good people, only basically what one might call road warrior culture, angry gangs clashing in the night. We put American troops into that situation with inadequate protection. We took casualties, and we left basically a chaotic situation that remains a chaotic situation. We do not seem to learn from these experiences. In Haiti, basically, a government that has never known democracy, which has an origin in blood, we had, although it has, I might add, a debt that we perhaps have paid, although I believe the debt was not paid in coin that the people of Haiti will spend. Just as a footnote, many of us may not know that we, in many respects, owe our existence as a nation, the United States does, to Haiti, as we now know it. In 1802, Napoleon Bonaparte sent a great army of 65,000 crack men under his brother-in-law, General Leclerc, to reoccupy his territory, the Louisiana Territory, and on their way they were to stop and put down a minor peasant revolt in Haiti. Well, the peasant revolt in Haiti, with a little help from yellow fever, swallowed that army, and without the army, Napoleon could not occupy his territory, and being unable to occupy his territory, he sold it to Tom Jefferson for a bargain. Very few people are aware that basically we owe that to the Haitians. I doubt that what we're doing for Haiti today, however, even from the point of view of the individual Haitians, repays the debt. Because what we're doing in Haiti is sustaining tyranny that has decorated itself with occasional elections and which will not change. And my concern is, but by bringing American boys into Haiti, sustaining tyranny, we stay there and we have not basically been moved to change our position only because we haven't taken casualties. If we took casualties, I believe the American faith in our government and in needed foreign policy initiatives would disappear. Haiti would hurt, in effect, what we need to have, which is a rationale by which we use our power for the forces of what is good in the world. Likewise, Bosnia. I won't dwell on it. It is too complex. They have hated each other for millennia. And we are in the middle of it, and when we leave, suffice it to say, the place probably will blow up. But we are doing it again because of other interests and because we are concerned that the Europeans lack the courage themselves to get involved in what may, in any event, be a hopeless cause. What I'm trying to say is that the world is a very complex place. We are a nation, because of our value on the life of the individual, in which sacrifice by the individual under arms has to have a strong moral color, or it has very little legitimacy within our system. We conservatives must replace the mantra of anti-communism with a sense of rightness and of proportion by which we can justify our future foreign policy, whether it be in Latin America against the problem of drugs, whether it be in the issues of immigration, and these are the two hot topics in American politics today that border on international affairs. Nothing else comes close. We must have a formula by which we can discuss the rightness and the basis for our relationships with foreign governments and peoples, and by which we can act. I would have ended my speech here, but for some discussions I heard this morning, which I think raise profound issues. Probably the toughest of these is the issue of drugs. And as an American ambassador in a Central American country, I've had to deal with it, and indeed the little speedboat that I personally owned had several bullet holes in it when I sold it that were gratuitously earned by our DEA people in Costa Rica, doing basic, not intercepts, but observations of drug-carrying vessels. So in a sense, I've been there. And indeed, if I had been the U.S. ambassador when the major drug lord, I think his name was Quintanilla, was taken in Costa Rica, I would like to think he would not be in a luxurious cell in Mexico had I been in charge of that operation. I believe that the United States, yes, must do something about the demand for drugs in our own country. But that demand grows out of a problem so severe and so culturally based, it will take a century or half a century to cure. It is no answer. We must, while we are attempting to address the pull, also hit the push. And in that respect, I believe issues of sufficient morality are raised that we can justify an active drug position in Latin America, but one which would be very different from what we're doing today, which is attempting to coerce governments that lack the will, the power, and in some cases, the integrity because of the inherent corruption of the drug money to do what has to be done. I will not attempt here to lay out a policy or to presume to lay out a policy for you, but merely to suggest some thoughts that I probably will regret later. But how many in this audience read Tom Clancy's book, Clear and Present Danger? Not too many. It's a great book, far better than the movie. But it raises some questions in terms of what might be done and what could be done and what, in some cases, perhaps should be done to deal with a problem that transcends government because of the corrupting potential of billions of dollars. In the Clancy book, it was done wrong. I believe it could be done correctly, and that the use of force can and should have profound moral sanction, not only for the people in this country, but for the victims of the problem in Latin America. I think on that note, I'll turn the floor over to my colleagues. Thank you very much.